Jonah chapter 4, verses 1 to 9. But Jonah was greatly displeased and became angry. He prayed to the Lord, "O Lord, is this not what I said when I was still at home? That is why I was so quick to flee Tarshish. I knew that you are a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for it is better for me to die than to live." But the Lord replied, "Have you any right to be angry?" Jonah went out and sat down at a place east of the city. There he made himself a shelter, sat in its shade and waited to see what would happen to the city. Then the Lord God provided a vine and made it grow up over Jonah to give him shade for his head to ease his discomfort. And Jonah was very happy about the vine. But at dawn the next day, God provided a worm, which chewed the vine so that it withered. When the sun rose, God provided a scorching east wind, and the sun blazed on Jonah's head so that he grew faint. He wanted to die and said, "It would be better for me to die than to live." But God said to Jonah, "Do you have a right to be angry about the vine?" "I do," he said. "I am angry enough to die." Amen.
Well, it's good for me to be with you this morning, and it's a great joy for me to dip into this story, this great story that you've been working your way through these last few weeks with Martin. And it would have been a great story if it had ended at chapter 3. A reluctant prophet restored, a rebellious city repentant, a relenting God revival. What a hopeful story. And I'm sure you've been inspired these last few weeks by some of the personal lessons and some of the missionary inspiration that's present in the story of Jonah. And then there's chapter 4. Disappointing, messy, and unfinished. And I would add one more word to it. Authentic. Chapter 4 is authentic to the complexity and perversity of human personality. Here's Nineveh experiencing the kind of revival that many long for, hope for, pray for in a season of unusual grace from heaven. But in the middle of this great event, one man is agonizing in displeasure. The preacher. What a perverse possibility. And yet we're like that sometimes. It's authentic to our spiritual experience that even after he's gone through this great teaching experience of the whale, Jonah is still reluctant to go God's ways at times. As Charles Wesley so fittingly put it in one of his hymns, "I have long withstood his grace, long provoked him to his face, would not hearken to his calls, grieved him by a thousand falls." Here's Jonah no longer taught a big lesson, then he's tripping up again, and disappointing again. Thirdly, it's authentic to our times. Some of us grew up with fairy tales where they all lived happily ever after. But the paradox of postmodernity is that though we've never had it so good, we've never been so miserable. And we don't know why. And the enigma that is Jonah may help us. There are few better times in all of the Old Testament than Jonah chapter 3. Few more remarkable stories. But there are few more miserable moments in all of Old Testament history than Jonah chapter 4. Few more despairing pictures. And I have to say that in all the kind of debate and whatever of how true this story is, and whether it's history or parable, and I know you've kind of gone into that a little bit in one of the weeks, it is chapter 4 above all other things in this story that convinces me that this is real. This is a real story
with real men and women in real history that really happened. Because it's chapter 4 that has the authentic ring, the complexity of my life and yours. Let's look at the anatomy of Jonah's condition. Very simply, the first verse tells us that Jonah was angry. Eugene Peterson writes this of anger: anger is a most useful diagnostic tool. When anger erupts in us, it's a signal that something is wrong. Evil or incompetence or stupidity or injustice is lurking in the neighborhood, and anger alerts us to that. But what anger fails to do is tell us whether that wrong is outside or inside us. We usually begin by assuming when we're angry that the wrong is outside us. That's what Jonah did. But often when we track the anger back to its real source, we find that the wrong is inside us. And we know those kind of people, don't we? We all know Mr. Angry. He's the one who turns up at a church meeting and is sorry that he has to speak on this issue, but he's always the one that somebody has spoken to and brought this concern to him, and he really needs to get it out in the open. He's the one who, whenever he goes on the road, whatever road he's on, it just coincides with the time when all the other bad drivers in the world are on that road. He's the one who, whatever job he takes, the office is full of incompetence. Whatever house he buys, the neighbors from hell have moved in next door. And if you don't know Mr. Angry, then you probably know his daughter, Little Miss Rage, who, whatever she buys from Marks and Spencer, there's a fault in it, and it has to be returned. Whatever public service she uses, it's disappointing, and there has to be a complaint made. And whatever she takes on in church, she's the one who never gets decent support for her efforts and is left to do it on her own. And the sad truth of Mr. Angry and Little Miss Rage is that they never consider the possibilities. Their anger as a diagnostic tool is pointing to a problem inside them rather than in the world around them. Secondly, Jonah was displeased. And his displeasure, it seems, is with God. He's very displeased. So displeased that three times he tells God he's had enough and he wants out. What are we to make of these dark and difficult words on Jonah's lips? Is he suffering from depression? Well, that's certainly a possibility. And it would be a great surprise, I think, if, having undergone the trials that Jonah went through, and if undertaking the preaching tour in a seemingly hostile environment that was Nineveh, he was not a little stressed. And his system was not at breaking point. It would not be at all surprising if under those kind of pressures he started to see the world through grey tinted lenses. And the Bible certainly has other cases of God's servants. Not least the one we were looking at with the children yesterday at Big Box, Elijah, suffering from the kind of symptoms of stress and burnout and depression that so many of us live with in our modern world. But I'm inclined to think, not least because God's answer to Jonah is a little different from his answer to Elijah, whom he simply allows to rest and nourishes with good food from heaven itself, that Jonah's real issue here is not so much depression brought on by stress, but more of a spiritual issue. It's not so much that his life is not functioning within a normal range, that the thermostat of his life is broken down, as his relationship with God is not functioning within a normal range. And he's completely out of sync with God. You know the story of
the proud Glaswegian parents who went down to see the passing out parade of their son at the barracks down south at the end of his military training. And as they walked along, rather embarrassingly, there was one boy not quite in step with the others. Of course, our Johnny's never wrong, so they were all out of step except our Johnny. Yeah. Major Roy here has seen it often, yeah. And sometimes we're a bit like that ourselves. That when things are not just the way we want, we assume that everyone else is out of step with us, and we are right. But the reality of Jonah's life is that he was out of step, out of sync with God. And he hadn't realized just how much. If you watch those amazing synchronized divers at the Olympics, you'll realize that they have so many parts of their body that could easily go out of sync. But to keep them all perfectly in tune is a remarkable thing. Well, I think there's probably at least three ways in which Jonah is out of sync with God. Let's explore them together. The first way I think he's out of sync is in his understanding of God's sovereignty. I think if you read through this text, the reasons are not immediately obvious, and we maybe need to delve under them just a little bit. And I want to suggest this may be one of the reasons that he's angry with God. You see, Nineveh was a threat to Israel. Pagan, godless, and more worryingly, next door. And the idea that God might wipe them out must have been extremely appealing to an Israelite like Jonah, who was patriotic for his people. You see, if the Ninevites were wiped out, then his people would be safer, more secure. Go right ahead, God, he must have thought. Go on, wipe them out. Your people will be more secure and more able to prosper if they're not there. What do you mean, give them a warning that you're going to do it? What do you mean, go and warn them that you're going to wipe them out? Why not just get on with it? You see, if I go and warn them, they might amend their ways, and you might not need to wipe them out. And that's what happened. And that may be what Jonah's saying to God. Don't you understand that by letting this people be, you've left us, your own precious people, insecure, under threat from this neighboring enemy? And underlying that concern is a lack of trust in God and in his keeping pure power. Humanly speaking, destroying Nineveh would have been the easiest way to guarantee Israel's safety. But God's ways are not our ways. Just as humanly speaking, it would have been sensible for Gideon to take his 32,000 men to take on the Midianites. But God's ways are not our ways, and he has to learn to trust God with just 300 men. Just as humanly speaking, it would have been sensible for David to wear Saul's armor to take on Goliath. In fact, it would have been sensible for David not to take him on at all. But God's ways are not our ways. And so he goes with only 5 stones. I was caused during the course of this week to reflect again on the psalmist's word on Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength. We will not fear if the earth give way or the mountain fall into the sea. Why can God not keep the earth from giving way or the mountain to fall into the sea? The psalmist says it's precisely when these things happen that we hold on to, indeed we may learn, that God is our refuge and our strength. Jonah had not yet learned that he could trust God's sovereignty. He thought his people would be safer if the Ninevites were wiped out. God had other ways. And Jonah had yet to learn. Secondly, he seems to be out of sync, and perhaps this more clearly emerges in the text, with God's grace. There's no doubt, absolutely no doubt, that Jonah knows God is a gracious God. Verse 3, is a quotation of absolute orthodox doctrine concerning the character of God. I know that you're a gracious and compassionate God. You're slow to anger. You're abounding in love. You're a God who relents from sending calamity. And there's no doubt that Jonah himself has experienced God's grace. How else would this disobedient prophet have survived the great fish? So he knows about God's grace and he's experienced it. But he doesn't understand it. He's not in sync with it. He's not in tune with it. It's fine for God to be gracious and kind to people like him, an Israelite, even disobedient people like him. But Nineveh is different. They are really wicked in Nineveh. And they deserve, quite frankly, all that God can throw at them. For their wickedness is great. And if God is gracious to them, in Jonah's mind, there's only one conclusion to be had. That God has gone soft on sin. If he's letting them off. Now let me in a couple of ways try and apply this Jonah test to ourselves. Suppose there is a woman in our village whose reputation goes before her, shall we say. She's been with several men in the village. And she's a place of comfort to many travellers. She comes in here for the very first time one Sunday morning. It's a communion Sunday. She hears God's word and it breaks her heart and she weeps. And she hears the invitation to the Lord's table and she comes. She comes right up here. And she sits here. She can't wait. And so she wants to be in the first seat. In her emptiness, she wants Jesus. How do you feel that Sunday morning as you look at her? As she enters the normal order of things and creates disorder, as she comes so inappropriately, how could she? I would struggle. And yet as I read the Gospels, I realize that puts me in the company of Simon the Pharisee. And not of Jesus the Lord. For it was Simon who found that woman of ill repute's actions of adoration and trust in Jesus so offensive, not Jesus. It was Simon who could not understand how Jesus could be gracious to that kind of woman. Don't you know what kind of woman this is? Don't you know, God, what the Ninevites are really like? I'll try this one. We all like a good testimony, don't we? A visitor comes from the south of England and he gives his testimony of how his life has been transformed by God. He was a violent man who, he's ashamed to tell us now, beat his wife and betrayed her love and his marriage. But God has transformed him and he marvels at what God has made him, and we see in the evidence of his life how God has used him. And we would thrill at such a story. But suppose that was a man who hurt and betrayed your daughter or your sister. And that was his story. Would you not just be a little cynical, or a little suspicious, or just a little angry? That guy doesn't deserve grace after what he did to my sister. And there's the oxymoron of all oxymorons. He doesn't deserve grace. But grace is only grace when it's not deserved, when it can't be won, when it has no right of call on it. And Jonah can't stomach grace towards the Ninevites. Thirdly, he seems to be out of sync in his understanding of God's place. Essentially, Jonah had done, if a little reluctantly, what God had wanted him to do. But God had not done what Jonah had wanted him to do. I've done the hard bit, gone into the lion's den and spoken of your coming judgment to them. But you haven't done what I said you would do. I've kept my side of the bargain, and boy, it was hard. And you've let your side of the bargain down, God. There's a negotiation been going on in Jonah's mind. That if he does what God has asked him to do, well then, God will surely do what he's longed for him to do and wipe those wicked Ninevites out. But God has disappointed him. Jonah has not yet learned that though God is gracious enough to make us his partners in the dance of his work, he always takes the lead. And we must always keep in step with him. You notice how often in those opening words of the chapter in this prayer that Jonah prays, the word I appears. Is this not what I said when I was still at home? This is why I was so quick to flee to Tarshish. You see, it's all about justifying himself. I was right. I knew all along. This is the way it would be. Let God be right, and all the world be wrong. The truth is, until we get into step and in step with God and his purposes, we will always be out of step and always at odds. And the gearbox of our life will always be crunching uncomfortably. If we would know anything else, we need to learn to recognize that God is God, and his ways and his words are paramount and primary. And our ways a long way behind us. Let me try and draw out two lessons as we conclude from this episode, when we see Jonah so seriously out of step and out of sync with God, and they're more encouraging lessons perhaps than the anatomy of his condition might suppose are possible in this episode. The first lesson is a very simple one, and it is this: that God is concerned with his servants and not just with their service. You see, it would have been very easy at this point for God to have washed his hands and said, well, I've got out of Jonah what I wanted out of Jonah. The task that I asked him to do, he's done. Now I can let him go and get on with his life. But that's not what God does. Because God is concerned with his servant and not just with his service. You can't have failed to have been amazed at the grace of God in Jonah's life as you've worked your way through this book. Not least in his deliverance, in his patience, and his provision. But have you ever considered how gracious it was of God to use Jonah, the preacher, when he didn't really... He wasn't really on message with God. His mighty big faults emerge in chapter 4. And God wasn't blind to them when he used him as the instrument of one of the greatest revivals of all history. How gracious God was to him. And how generous his provision, as he provides. If you look through the book, you'll see the word continually comes out. He provided a fish. He provided here a plant. And then he provides a worm. And he provides wind. And all the time in this provision, God is teaching, training, correcting. And here in the rest of the chapter, he patiently reasons with him and seeks to teach him. I find that very refreshing in a world, the world that most of you live in, that drops us when we don't measure up first time. And I want to say to all of you this morning that employment in God's service brings with it the best conditions of any employer. Because God is not only interested in your service, but in his servant. It's not a question of getting from us what he needs, and that's the end of it. It's a question of him making us what he desires for us in the midst of our service, and fulfilling his high purposes in us. Secondly, God is concerned with living truth and not just dead orthodoxy. Here is Jonah. And as we said earlier in verse 2, he's got the character of God spot on. In fact, if he was to teach dogmatics in a university, he couldn't have a better text to begin to teach the character of God. But he hasn't got the character of God pulsating through his own life. He knows it in his head, but he doesn't live it in his heart. And God is concerned not only with orthodox belief, but with living truth in our hearts and in our lives. The home groups last month in our studies in Philippians, we were looking at that verse of Paul's, conduct yourself in a manner worthy of the gospel. And I've been thinking a lot about that and chatting about that to people over this month, about what that really means. Conducting ourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel. It seems to me that if we understand that at the heart of the gospel essentially is grace, to live in a manner worthy of the gospel means essentially practicing grace. Practicing grace. And sometimes it takes a long time for that to become the beating pulse of our heart. Let me say to you words that have troubled me for about 3 weeks now, that I've talked over with one or two of you already, about someone who's been on the fringes of our congregation. I asked her how she was getting on and where she was in her understanding of the faith, and she said, well, I'm troubled by the exclusiveness of it all. And I thought, well, I'm ready for this. I have my text to defend the exclusive claims of Jesus. She said, no, that's not the problem. She said, the problem is this. You say that the gospel in the church is for sinners. But she said, as I come near you and dip my toe in the water, I realize it's not for sinners like me, but only for sinners who've got it sorted. It's not for people like me whose life is still a mess. And I wonder if that girl had ever come near Jesus, if she would ever have got that message from him. I don't think so. Because pulsating through the life and heart of Jesus at every sense and at every stage was grace that said to sinners, whatever mess they were in, there is something here for you. And however orthodox we are in our belief, we need most of all to live the truth in our lives. I remember when my mother had cancer 2 or 3 years ago, she had to undergo both radiotherapy and chemotherapy. And that's my understanding of how these things work, is they work in these ways. Radiotherapy attacking a very small stubborn place intensively, and chemotherapy a very big part of our bodies extensively. And as God gets to work in our lives, He does that double movement too. There are some attitudes that are hard and harsh that He has to work very intensively on to reform in the manner of grace. Maybe for Jonah, there was a bit of patriotism or nationalism or racism even there, the kernel of his life, that had not yet changed. Some of us have those kind of issues that grace still needs to penetrate and win. But it also needs to go into every corner of our life, into the extremities of our lives, into the fingertips and toenails of our lives, so that in all parts of our lives, grace is seen and experienced. God is concerned not just with orthodox belief, but with living truth. Come thou fount of every blessing, tune my heart to sing thy grace. O, to grace how great a debtor daily I am constrained to be. Let that grace, Lord, like a fetter, now bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I trust. Take my heart, oh, take and seal it. Seal it with thy gracious love. Let's pray together.